Well, John Newton was born in 1725. He was the only son of a Captain Newton, who was the master of a ship which traded in the Mediterranean. And John didn't really get on too well with his father. In fact, he was terrified of him and dreaded the times when he would be home from sea. But by contrast, he had a gentle and much loved mother who was of dissenting background, and she gave herself almost exclusively to the task of bringing up her son, particularly to know the Lord. And John had an incredibly retentive memory, and so he, by the time he was six, he had already memorized vast sections of scripture and many hymns and passages out of some of the Christian books of his time. Well, his mother died when he was seven, and as a result his devotional life began to dwindle rapidly. And then when his father returned a year later and remarried, he was dispatched to boarding school, and his life there was a misery. So by the time he was 9 or 10, he'd become quite indifferent to religion. He was 11 when he first went on board his father's ship and experienced the thrill of being at sea. But sharing the captain's cabin was no joy to him, and he says, "I was with him in a state of fear and bondage." And it was during this and subsequent voyages with his father that he became more and more introspective. He tried desperately to recall his mother's devotional studies, and he made his first attempts at keeping a diary, recording his more worthy thoughts and emotions. But at the same time, he was being confronted by the curses and the blasphemies of the sailors. Two near-death incidents when he was 12 and 15 faced him with the dreadful consequences if in such a state he had been summoned to appear before God, and he made fresh resolutions, but nothing lasted. And he later wrote, "Oh, I could see the necessity of religion as a means of escaping hell, but I loved sin and was unwilling to forsake it." It was when he was about 16 that a chance reading of a book by Lord Shaftesbury came to exercise a profound influence on his thinking, and it operated on him like a slow poison. It led him to believe that honest doubt in religion was not the same as atheism, and it opened a new world of freedom in his thinking, but it was the thin edge of the wedge, and he gradually gave up all considerations of a religious nature, and instead of praying, he said, "I learned to curse and blaspheme." In 1742, when he was 17, Captain Newton arranged for John to sail to the West Indies. It would be an adventurous life where his every need and desire would be met by African slaves. But a week before he was to sail, close friends of his mother's, the Cartletts, invited him to visit them in Chatham. And it was at the Cartletts' home that he met Mary. She was the eldest child and almost 14. John had never met a girl like her. Virtually at first sight, he felt an affection for her. She was so beautiful, so gentle, so vivacious, so full of fun. And yet he was so shy and self-conscious that he was struck dumb every time she came into the room. But as those first happy days passed at the Cartletts, he resolved not to go to Jamaica. And so he stayed with them a further 2 weeks until he was sure that his ship must have sailed. And only then did he reluctantly return to London to face the wrath of his father. Well, the angry Captain Newton soon dispatched him on a ship bound for Venice. No longer the comfort and the exclusion of the captain's cabin, he was now bunked in the crowded forecastle with the rest of the crew, where there was no escaping their coarse companionship. And so very soon he began to relax his strict habits, and though he made some feeble efforts to reform, again, nothing lasted. And he rapidly headed towards total apostasy. Nevertheless, he couldn't get Mary out of his mind. He wrote, "I soon lost all sense of religion and became deaf to the remonstrances of conscience and prudence, but my regard for her was always the same, And I may perhaps venture to say that none of the scenes of misery and wickedness I afterwards experienced ever banished her 1 hour from my waking thoughts for the next 7 years. At that time, he refused to allow himself to be involved with other women, although the opportunities were many. And on those occasions when women were smuggled on board for the crew's pleasure, Newton would escape up the mast to the crow's nest, out of reach of all but his companions' derisive laughter. But it was a year before the ship returned to England, and within days he was bound for Chatham to see his dear Mary. During his absence, he had many times dreamed of ways of obtaining sudden fame and fortune which might enable him to ask her to marry him. Meantime, Captain Newton had found another job prospect for his unpredictable son. But just as on the first visit to Chatham, John was so infatuated with Mary that he was weeks late in returning to London, and the ship had sailed by the time he arrived back. His father was furious and threatened to disown him. Of course, he knew nothing of the real reason for his son's tardiness. Now, we need to understand that in Newton's day, the inhumane treatment that men suffered on the Royal Naval ships was so bad that it was impossible for the authorities to supply warships with volunteers. And so the infamous press gangs were employed to force men into naval service. And these gangs were out looking for crew to man the HMS Harwick when John Newton was caught in the wrong place in the wrong time. And so by nightfall he was on board a tender belonging to the British warship. When Captain Newton heard that his son had fallen victim to the press gangs, he was in two minds as to what to do. On the one hand, his pride was ruffled at the thought of a son of his in that state, and yet he thought it might do John some good to have to suffer the rigours of naval life. In the end, he relented and obtained the goodwill of the captain of the Harwick to have the young Newton elevated to the quarter deck as a midshipman. Within days, England had declared war against France, and the Harwick, with Newton on board, was assigned to convoy duty. They had but one brief engagement with a French man of war, and the thunder of guns and the crash of shot and the shredding sails and falling timbers gave Newton his first experience of war. By the end of 1744, the Harwick was back in England and due to sail to India. It would probably be away for 5 years. Oh, Newton wanted badly to propose to Mary. He was so deeply in love and yet so lacking in self-confidence that he tormented himself with the thoughts of his own clumsiness. And he imagined that Mary must surely look with favour on some more polished rival. He had just 1 day's leave in which to see her again. And so against all common sense, he hired a horse and rode to Chatham. The visit was a disaster. Mary's parents forbade him either to visit again or in any way to correspond with their 15-year-old daughter. He was crushed, not only by their prohibition, but also by Mary's apparent lukewarmness towards him. How could he face being away from England for 5 years, not knowing if she truly loved him? So in desperation, he jumped ship and deserted. Within days, he was recaptured and returned to the Harwick, not as a midshipman now, but as a felon to await punishment. He was placed in irons and confined below decks. In the foul, cold air and in pitch darkness, he was left to contemplate his unknown fate. He dreaded the thought that he had now forfeited all hope of Mary's love, and his recriminations brought him to the border of madness, and he now burned with hatred towards everyone. And the day they were to sail, the crew were assembled on deck to witness Newton's court-martial and flogging. He was stripped and lashed to a grating. "Give him the first dozen." The cat-o'-nine-tails swung, repeatedly lashing his bare back until his white skin was red and lacerated with lacerated flesh. His audience watched in sickened silence. One young marine fainted. Lash after lash pounded his torn back. The 8 dozen strokes left him near to unconsciousness. The disgrace and humiliation dramatically changed Newton. He was filled with rage against the captain and contemplated murdering him and then of throwing himself overboard. He wrote later, I think nothing I either felt or feared distressed me so much as to see myself thus forcibly torn away from the object of my affection under such a great improbability of seeing her again. My breast was filled with the most excruciating passions, eager desire, bitter rage, and black despair. Inward or outward, I could perceive nothing but darkness and misery. I cannot express with what wishfulness and regret I cast my last look upon the English shore. Newton didn't altogether abandon conventional morality, because thoughts of Mary were still in his mind, and for her sake he endured insults and mounting hardship, never putting into action his designs upon the captain or of suicide. He could not bear the thought that she would think badly of him when he was dead. Some weeks later, extraordinary circumstances prevailed which enabled Newton to transfer out of the Navy to a passing merchant ship. Suddenly he was amongst strangers who knew nothing of his pious past nor of his desertion and flogging. And so a new life of liberty to think and live as he pleased lay before him. And now at last he was free to do what he liked without restraint. Well, not until he was on board this new vessel did he discover that its captain and the crew were engaged in the slave trade. He soon became known as careless, insubordinate, foul-mouthed, and no respecter of morality. He especially derived great pleasure from poking fun at religion. His determination to live as a free thinker led him into a devil-may-care attitude that had no restraint on any sin that came to mind, and he made it his habit to tempt and seduce everyone he could to his way of life. He had a talent for composing obscene verse, and there was an occasion when he even directed one of these offensive ballads to his incensed captain. On board, he became friends with a resident slave trader from West Africa named Amos Clow. He began to scheme. If only he could settle somewhere ashore and follow Clow's example, he might in a year or two return to England with a fortune, marry Mary, and quit the sea forever. And so he begged Clow to take him with him. And Newton found himself ashore on an island off the coast of Guinea in the middle of the iniquitous slave trade. Clow's black native mistress, P.I., as she was called, had no liking for Newton and viewed him with suspicion and hostility. It was not long before the combination of climate and hard manual labour took its toll and the 19-year-old succumbed to fever. He was too ill to accompany Clow on his next trip and was left in P.I.'s care. Far from looking after him, she virtually left him to die. I had sometimes not a little difficulty to procure a draught of water when burning with fever. My bed was a mat spread upon a board or chest and a log of wood for my pillow. She lived in plenty herself, but hardly allowed me sufficient to sustain life, except now and then, when in the highest good humour, she would send me food in her own plate after she had dined. Newton's hunger was at times so great that in spite of his abject weakness, he would crawl out into the plantation under the cover of darkness to find grass roots for food. This hardly sufficed, and had not some of the chained black slaves taken pity on him and secretly given him food of their own, he would have certainly died. Well, Newton recovered enough to accompany Clow on his next trip. But Clow was so suspicious of Newton that he would never go ashore without first chaining him to the deck. Newton would be left for days on end exposed to the elements and without adequate food or water. He would suffer the blistering heat of the unrelenting sun only to be lashed hours later by the chilling gales of a storm. And so he was often left soaked and starved and numb with the cold. Somehow he survived. But in every sense of the word, he was now just another of Clow's chattels. His situation was hopeless. There was no escape, no opportunity for improvement. And so for a year he worked on Clow's plantation as much a slave as any Negro. With his tattered clothes and shameful occupation, he dreaded ever being seen by any of his fellow countrymen, and if a ship happened to pass or men came ashore for supplies, he would hide among the trees. Newton even began to take on some of the superstitions of the pagan culture of those amongst whom he now lived. And he actually came to believe it was unsafe to sleep when the moon was visible. He viewed himself as being in Satan's service and thought it luck that had preserved him when he survived an attack by a lioness, or when someone found an adder coiled up in his pallet. Then in February 1747, some men came ashore from a passing ship inquiring of the locals, "Have you heard of a white man named John Newton?" They were there on behalf of his father. More than anything else, John wanted to be in England with his Mary, but he was in deep poverty and had nothing to offer her. He might as well stay put. "Make up your mind," urged the impatient captain. "Besides," he lied, "one of your relatives has died and left you £400 a year." Newton could hardly believe his ears. He needed no further persuasion and immediately boarded ship for the 12-month voyage back to England. He had no responsibilities on board, and so often engaged in drinking orgies with some of the crew, one of which nearly cost his life. But his main hobby was inventing new forms of blasphemy. These were not the normal curses and swearing of a rough seaman, but carefully thought out expressions of revolt against the very idea of God. He says, "My life, when awake, was a course of most horrid impiety and profaneness. I know not that I have ever met so daring a blasphemer. Not content with common oaths and imprecations, I daily invented new ones." One day, though, Newton came across a copy of Thomas A. Kempis's book on the Imitation of Christ. For some reason, he picked it up and began to read it. "Since life is of short and uncertain continuance, it highly concerns you to look about you and take good heed how you employ it. All the hardness of men's hearts, all the wretched stupidity that fixes their whole thoughts and cares upon the present, whereas in truth, every work and word and thought ought to be so ordered as if it were to be our last, and we instantly die and render an account of it." What if these things should be true, thought Newton. But then, alarmed by his reaction as much as by its words, he angrily threw the book aside. No, he was a free thinker, and he would live with the consequences. The very next night, a violent storm descended upon them. Wave after wave pounded the vessel, smashing the sides, tearing the rigging, and filling the hold with water. "She's sinking," went up the urgent cry. And Newton joined the crew in the hopeless task of bailing with buckets. Hour after hour they battled. Some of the crew were washed overboard, as was all the livestock and much of the cargo. At dawn the wind abated somewhat, and there was this frantic activity to plug the leaks and continue bailing. But all hope of them surviving was lost. Newton says, "About 9 o'clock, being almost spent with cold and labour, I went to speak to the captain who was busied elsewhere, and just as I was returning from him, I said, almost without meaning, 'If this will not do, the Lord have mercy on us.' As he staggered back, he was instantly struck with his own words. 'Why did I say that? I didn't intend to. It was not intentional, it just happened. Anyway, would the Lord have mercy on the ship and upon the crew and upon me? If indeed there was a God, what mercy could there be for such a blasphemer as John Newton?' For days the bad weather continued, but somehow the ship remained afloat. Finally they were free from water, but by no means out of danger. The rigging was badly damaged, with many of the sails in tatters. They had no idea where they were, and had food only for another 7 days. Meantime, Newton's mind was racing. Though he could not explain or understand what was happening, he now knew that he was not alone. He was convinced that his sins were too great to be forgiven, and his excellent memory was now recalling some terrifying scriptures that he had learned in childhood. 'Because I have called and you refused to listen, have stretched out my hand and no one has heeded, and you have ignored all my counsel and would have none of my reproof, I also will laugh at your calamity. I will mock when panic strikes you, when panic strikes you like a storm, and your calamity comes like a whirlwind, when distress and anguish come upon you. Then they will call upon me, but I will not answer. They will seek me diligently, but will not find me. Well, amazingly, these scriptures didn't crush him. And day after day, he took his turn at the helm, sometimes for 11 hours at a time, steering the frail ship through the mountainous waves. All the time, he was re-examining what he believed. Tentatively, he began to pray. He wanted evidence that God was real. He wanted faith. He wanted assurance that the scriptures were of divine inspiration. He wanted to be able to exercise trust and hope in God. But as yet, he couldn't do so. On the sixth day, land was sighted. It had to be Ireland. Out came the last of their food in celebration. But within a few hours, the frustrated crew found themselves becalmed, and the clouds they thought were land passed away. Another gale bore down upon them and blew them off course. It raged on, and again all hope was lost of the ship and crew surviving. No wonder the captain began to think of Newton as a Jonah. Throw him overboard, the crew demanded. But what no one realised was that from the moment of his spontaneous prayer during the height of the storm, Newton had stopped swearing. In fact, the words of the scriptures were now burning into him. If you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more shall your heavenly Father give the Holy Spirit to them that ask him? He reasoned, if this book be true, the promise of this passage is true, and I have need of that very Spirit by which the whole was written in order to understand it, he has promised here to give that Spirit to those who ask. I must therefore pray, and if it is of God, he will make good his own word. For almost a month they drifted helplessly. Finally, the damaged ship and starving crew made land on the north of Ireland. None were more aware of the providence and kindness of God than Newton. It was no longer a question, is there a God, but what is God like and how may I truly know him? And so by the end of his stay, recuperating in Northern Ireland, Newton had become what he called a serious professor. He said, I stood in need of an almighty Saviour, and such a one I found described in the New Testament. I was no longer an infidel. I hardly renounced my former profaneness. I had taken up some right notions, was seriously disposed and sincerely touched with a sense of the undeserved mercy that I had received in being brought safely through so many dangers. And he said later on, I acknowledged the Lord's mercy in pardoning what was past, but I was depending chiefly upon my own resolutions to do better for the time to come. And so I cannot consider myself to have been a believer in the full sense of the word until a considerable time afterwards. Well, Newton's thoughts very soon turned to hopes of seeing Mary, but he dared not visit Chatham, and so he wrote to one of Mary's aunts, pleading with her for news. Was Mary alive and well? Was she still unmarried? He also wrote to his father, telling him not only of his adventures, but of his love for Mary Cartlett. Captain Newton had long since assumed that his son had perished, and the arrival of the letter deeply moved him. Not only did he reply to John in most affectionate terms, but found time to visit the Carters to speak to them about Mary, giving his consent should the two young people wish to marry. Oh, as soon as Newton found out, he boarded the first coach for London, then hired a horse and rode to Chatham. When he saw Mary, he melted. With his heart beating wildly, he tried to utter the ardent words of love that he had rehearsed all the way from Liverpool. But he was tongue-tied and scarcely dared look at her. Every attempt by the shy and bashful young sailor to speak his mind was a disaster. Mary was clearly disappointed. So he returned to Liverpool and a new... He returned to Liverpool and a new posting, humiliated and distressed by his feeble and bumbling performance. And although Newton wrote often, Mary replied but once. Her answer, though cautious, satisfied him. She was not attached to anyone else and was willing to wait for him until the end of his new voyage. Well, Newton was now 23 and mate aboard the Brownlow, a slave trader from Guinea. And it was not long before he fell into many of his old ways, in particular, succumbing to all his old lusts. Who would not expect to hear that after such a wonderful and unhoped-for deliverance as I had received, and after my eyes were in some measure enlightened to see things aright, I should immediately cleave to the Lord and his ways with purpose of heart, and consult no more with flesh and blood? Alas, it was far otherwise with me. And by the time he arrived back at the same island where he had been a slave to Clough, he was, his swearing accepted, almost as bad as before. He seemed to have forgotten all the Lord's mercies, and again he went down with fever. But this time, weak and almost delirious, he resolved to cast himself upon the Lord as never before, and to have him to do with him as he should please. On his return to England, Newton was promised the captaincy of a ship for his next voyage, and so he wasted no time in visiting Chatham, where he was determined to propose to Mary. My heart was so full it beat and trembled to that degree that I knew not how to get a word out. I sat stupid and speechless. When at last he did begin to speak, Mary, with a swift change of mood, said quite firmly, "I can't marry you, and you must not mention the subject again." Not put off, John tried again, and once more she forbade him to speak of such things. A third time he spoke his mind, only to be told that he was much too good for her. John now pressed upon her his passionate love, until finally she gave her hand in consent, and a fortnight later they were married in St. Margaret's, Rochester. It was 6 months before Newton could set sail as captain of the Duke of Argyll. It was a worrying time, with little or no money to support his young wife, and as was the custom of his day, he gambled often and stopped only when he realised how much in debt he'd become. Newton's time on the Duke of Argyll was very difficult. And we need to realise that in his day and age, slave trading was called a genteel employment. And traders, even Christians, looked on their cargo just as they might so much cattle. They valued them by height and physique, entering them in the ledger alongside accounts of elephant tusks and pineapples and hardwood. Well, by the time he arrived back in November of 1751, almost half his crew had died. Many of the slaves never made it to North America. And the voyage was hardly considered a financial success, and the Duke of Argyll, well, it was battered and worn out and declared unseaworthy, and so a new ship, the African, was promised to the young captain. His first voyage on the African was also filled with trouble. There were numerous insurrections among the slaves, and many died or committed suicide. For his part, news of Mary was scarce, and at one stage he became convinced that the long silence could only mean that she had died. He was frantic with anxiety. He was especially terrified that she might die in childbirth, and for that reason determined never to have children. He was convinced that his own idolatrous heart, though, was its own punishment, and with no news of Mary, he lost his appetite, had pains in his stomach, suffered an imaginary stroke, but wrote in his diary, "Oh, my complaint was not all grief. Conscience had a share. I thought my unfaithfulness to God had deprived me of her, especially my backwardness in speaking of spiritual things, which I could hardly attempt even to her." Newton was returned and was about to embark on another voyage when he suffered a strange seizure, and he was advised not to sail and resigned his commission. And in fact never went to sea again. It was during this time that he'd been reading some of the letters published by George Whitefield and John Wesley. And they had led him to come to adore the free grace of God, as he put it. And two of his London friends invited him to visit and hear Whitefield. And that first encounter left a deep impression. The next evening he went back again to hear Whitefield. He said a prodigious multitude of people were gathered, so that besides those who stayed in the yard, many hundreds were forced to go away. The place was supposed to contain 5,000. And morning after morning he returned to hear Whitefield preach. And then in August in 1755, Newton secured a job in Liverpool as the tide surveyor. and the customs service there brought new trials and temptations because smuggling was common and very widely accepted. The customs officers were often a party to the trade, knowing that they could receive worthwhile gratuities on the side. And although at first he took part in the practice, he came to realise, as he wrote, that he was reaping some of the profits of his new office, but to his grief found too much of the love of money, which is the root of all evil, springing up in his heart. And so he quit having anything to do with it. And then in September of that year, George Whitfield visited Liverpool, and Newton eagerly joined the 4,000 or so who gathered at 5 a.m. each morning to hear him preach. And he spent some time talking with Whitfield, and presumably that was a very valuable time for Newton, as Whitfield shared with him some of the great truths of the gospel and the great doctrines of grace, as Whitfield put it. Meantime, Newton was busy teaching himself Greek and Hebrew. But he soon found that it took up too much time. He said, "I would rather be useful to others than die with a reputation as an eminent linguist." Well, England was by that time in the midst of what we now call the Great Evangelical Awakening. And the preaching of Whitfield and the Wesleys was shaking the nation. And there was a widespread and growing concern for matters of one's soul and of sin and of salvation. And so the Methodist societies, the Baptists and the Independents were all rapidly growing in numbers, much to the ire of the clergy of the established church. And it was during this time that Newton had his first thoughts of entering the ministry. He said, "As my life has been full of remarkable turns and I seemed selected to show what the Lord could do, I had some hope that perhaps sooner or later he might call me into his service." And so he entered this period of great heart searching. And one thing he came to realise was that his love for Mary was idolatrous. And she in turn wrote, "I delight, admire and love to hang upon every sense and every action of my dearest John, and yet how wanting and how cold am I to the gracious author of all our mercies, to whom we owe each other our happy affection and all the satisfactions that flow from it." He also began to curb his ready wit, realising that though it was a gift of God, it was often exercised out of place. He called it a dangerous talent, which needs much grace to restrain and much judgment to manage. Well, then all his attempts to apply to be ordained in the Church of England failed. No one would give him the required testimonials, because he associated with the Methodists. And then when he did find someone, he couldn't get a bishop who would ordain him. And he was determined that if the established church wouldn't have him, then he would join the dissenters. And just as he'd been made, he was about to accept an invitation from the Presbyterians when he was offered a curacy in Buckinghamshire. And so the Bishop of Lincoln agreed to ordain him. And at 39, Newton found himself a clergyman in the established church, curate in the little lace-making village of Olney. Well, he seemed to have had great difficulty overcoming his nervousness in learning to preach in front of his congregation, but learn he did. Didn't like long sermons. He said, "There's an old-fashioned instrument called an hourglass, which used to be the good measure of a sermon, and I think it's a tolerable stint." He says, "When weariness begins, edification ends. Perhaps it's better to feed our people like chickens a little often." "Than to cram them like turkeys till they cannot hold one goblet more." "Besides," he says, "overlong sermons break in upon family concerns and often call off the thoughts from the sermon to the pudding, which is in danger of being overboiled." Well, Newton maintained a consistent and faithful ministry to the relatively poor residents of Olney, preaching often a dozen sermons a week, visiting his people in their little factories, praying with them in their cottages. Congregation often numbered 2,000. And as the years passed, Newton became well known, and he was made many offers to move to more prominent parishes, but he refused, concerned as to what would happen to his little flock at Olney. "A parish is an awful millstone to those who see nothing valuable in the flock but the fleece." In 1767, William Cowper, or Cooper, William Cowper and his housekeeper, Mrs. Unwin, moved to Olney. Now, Cowper was known, well known by then, to be a great man of God, and his desire was to be an instrument to turn people to the truth, but he was also subject to melancholy. He'd had a number of breakdowns, he'd attempted suicide several times, he'd spent 18 months in a mental asylum, but he came to Olney just to be near Newton. And that began a remarkable friendship. The Lord evidently sent him to Olney, Newton wrote, where he's been a great blessing to many, and certainly a great blessing to myself. Well, in Newton's day, thousands of hymns were coming from the pens of men like the Wesleys and Watts and Doddridge. And Newton began to think of the need of his flock for verses to encourage them in the faith. And so in 1769, he and Cowper each wrote a hymn to be sung on the occasion of a new prayer meeting in Olney. And these hymns became famous. And it was the beginning of a partnership in hymn writing which culminated in the publication of the Olney collection of hymns. Cowper wrote 68, Newton 280. Newton tried to write one a week. Cowper was less systematic. And I guess Amazing Grace is the one that we know best, and we've sung several others already this morning. Well, for 6 years, Newton and Cowper enjoyed a combined ministry in Olney, but then in 1770, Cowper suddenly had a relapse. And gloom descended on him. Newton rushed to his side. And he tried to commit suicide again. Well, his melancholy became habitual from then on. And although he was able to maintain some degree of equilibrium, he was never the same man. And he continued his close fellowship with Newton and attempted to maintain his writing, especially that of composing hymns. Great mystery. Godly man. In 1779, Newton was offered the church in London at St Mary's Woolnoth, and he decided that he should move. And so that began a totally new ministry in his life. It was a mixed congregation with shopkeepers, artisans, rich merchants, and it was one of the few evangelical established churches in the whole of London. News of his arrival brought so many folk that the regular congregation complained that they couldn't always get into their favourite pew. It was at St Mary's that he met William Wilberforce. He was a young parliamentarian, friend of the Prime Minister, William Pitt. And as many of you know, it was William Wilberforce, under the close instruction and pastoring of John Newton, who pushed forward the motion for the abolition of slavery in Parliament, which was finally passed in 1804. Many of us know a lot about Newton from his letters. He was a prolific letter writer, and many of those are available for us to read today. All his letters to Mary exist, every one of his 200 letters that he wrote to her, and so too many of his sermons. One of the things which struck me about Newton in the latter part of his life was just the consistency of his ministry to those congregations. And we haven't got time to go into it, but his involvement with them, his concern and care and pastoring, sharing with them at a very practical level in a most beautiful and consistent way. But he was also widely read. He read all about Captain Cook's voyage to the southern hemisphere and this strange place that he'd come across. And his concern for the people of that land. And it was Newton, together with a group of others, who were involved in the founding of the Church Missionary Society, with which some of you have been associated. In 1788, Mary became ill, and she was told that she had breast cancer. Newton was devastated. He knew that his love for her had been an inordinate affection. My conscience told me that I well deserved to be wounded where I was most sensitive, and it was my duty to submit with silence to the will of the Lord. But I felt that unless he was pleased to give me this submission, I was more likely to toss like a wild bull in a net in defiance of my better judgment. And she finally died in 1790. For him, life without Mary was inconceivable. But go on, he must. Several months after her death, he was trying to pray, and a thought suddenly struck him with unusual force, grief is self-indulgence. The Lord wants us to have peace and to be at peace, and we should resist grief. And so he said aloud, Lord, I am indeed helpless in myself, and I hope I am willing, though without reservation, for you to help me. He saw that he had loaned her to him, and he who had loaned her had the right to take her back when he chose. With failing memory and poor eyesight, Newton continued to faithfully preach into his 80s, and one Sunday after he had rambled on for 50 minutes, a friend commented, his understanding is in ruins, yet its very ruins are precious, and bits you pick up retain their intrinsic value and beauty and richness. Well, the time came when Newton was so blind that he could not even see his text, and it became more and more obvious that preaching was beyond him, but he was indignant when it was hinted that he should give it up. What? Shall the old African blasphemer stop while he can still speak? But in October 1806, he mounted the pulpit for the last time, and as it was, the poor old man completely forgot what he was preaching about. And someone was obliged to enter the pulpit and remind him of his subject. By now he was very frail, though not ill or in pain, just old. And to a friend he wrote, I am packed and sealed and waiting for the post. And to another he said, I'm like a person going on a journey in a stagecoach who expects its arrival every hour and is frequently looking out for it, waiting for it to come. Well, the coach came on the 21st of December, 1807, and he was 82.